Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Caged In, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. You join us for one of our many Caged In Coppola Connections will be back next week, kinda. We'll be dropping into that, but less about that and more onto this week's conversation. I talked to Andrew Morgan Smith, the composer for Nicolas Cage's first foray into the Western genre, The Old Way, all about how he worked on that film from the initial ideas, kind of merging traditional Western soundtracks with some kind of fresh Rocky Mountain folk music ideas that he had. We kind of get into all of it, composing kind of in this new era since the pandemic, low-budget movies, the love-hate relationship with temp music. We kind of go all over the place. This is a great conversation and a lot of fun. So, yeah, sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Andrew Morgan Smith. Today, I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by film composer Andrew Morgan Smith, a name you may recognize if you recently watched the fantastic The Old Way, and you would have heard Andrew's amazing music. How are you today, Andrew?
Thank you so much for having me, man. I'm doing pretty good.
Let's jump in with what's the reception been like for you, like with The Old Way, especially when people are mentioning the music? It's definitely something that has stayed with me since watching the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think the response to the movie itself has been pretty great. It kind of, if I'm being honest, it's kind of landing exactly where I thought it would with the audience. through the whole process, I kind of personally felt, okay, I feel like we're going to be in like that 70% range, which at least last I saw, I think that's exactly where we were sitting with the audience. You know, it's a fun ride. We're not trying to be anything that we're not. And I think the other thing that's so interesting with the reception to the movie is we're kind of going with the term classic studio Western.
Yes.
Because it's not what you get with some of these more modern Westerns where it's very gritty, trying to be really brutally honest about what the West was, right? It's going back to this idealized studio Western from like the 40s and the 50s, and then there's kind of resurgence in the 80s again, now we're kind of getting a lot of this, and most reviews of the music have been really positive. You know, I think most people who didn't like the music didn't like the movie generally, or didn't really understand what we were shooting for by not creating some, you know, gritty hellscape.
That's kind of interesting because, like, coming out of TIFF, obviously Butcher's Crossing, another Nick Cage film premiered there, and all of the kind of press for that was them saying exactly what you're saying, that gritty Western, like, this is an anti-Western. We're showing how kind of brutal and unforgiving the West probably actually was. And it's kind of, I imagine it's quite refreshing to see something that's in that kind of archetypal mold of those films, like whether it is like the John Ford classics and stuff like that, something that is like the big studio music musical. What was I saying? Sorry, I've been watching a lot of musicals recently.
Yeah,
the big studio western.
Yeah,
and there's and I think the score really adds to that, and just kind of I really want to dive into that. But before I do, I just wanted to ask you, when did you first notice what a composer was doing and the kind of impact they had on a film? Like, was that an early memory for you?
Actually, it's funny. I grew up loving film music. I remember one of my earliest music memories as a kid is this cassette tape of, it was called Pops in Space. It was, Boston Pops recording of a bunch of John Williams music. And for those of you who don't know, the Boston Pops was, basically, like, John Williams actually conducted for a while. Like, he's been heavily involved with them. And I had this tape even before I remember even watching most of these movies, and I would listen to it. And so I've always loved film music, but I didn't really see it as a career path until I was in high school and I saw the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, it really popped for me. Like, that was I must have saw the movie 7 times in theaters. And for whatever reason, I just really, just like the marriage of music to film, all this kind of stuff, just really said, I want to do that to myself. And that was like kind of up to that point, I played music. I took piano lessons. I played guitar. I played in band. I played in all these different things. So it wasn't like my father was very musical. So came from a musical background, but it just wasn't a thing that I necessarily saw myself doing until that point.
What was the kind of music that was on in the house when you were a kid? Was it kind of, what was it? Was there a lot of film music, or was it kind of like, I don't know, rock, yeah, like jazz?
Oh yeah. I mean, we didn't listen to much rock. I mean, we listened to musicals. We listened to film music. We listened to a bunch of stuff like that. It just kind of instilled from me in a very young age, the love of the genre.
Mm-hmm.
Right now. But I don't know, man, for whatever reason, I wanted to be a composer, right? Like, at that point, like I took piano lessons, and actually to get out of playing piano, like my mom would make me practice piano every day. And so I would like make stuff up and I'd say, oh, I'm composing, 'cause I just didn't want to practice what I was supposed to practice. My first composed piece actually was a piece that, my dad had set up like a MIDI, a very rudimentary early, MIDI setup to go into the computer, and it played into this. I played into this, notation software, and I just made it up as I went. And then my piano teacher thought, oh, this is great. Let's make him actually perform it. So I had to like perform this piece of music I wrote, right? Quote unquote wrote. And it was obviously embedded in my mind of like, this is terrifying. Because it was just like random nonsense. Growing up, I was always kind of surrounded by that kind of thing, playing in like concert bands and playing in, piano and all that kind of stuff.
What was it, that kind of moment you kind of thought like, well, I can just write something and don't have to have this. And obviously, like being like a concert pianist or being a part of a band, there is that. Not added. It's almost like that pressure of, we've got to go out multiple nights a week or whatever and play this stuff. And was that the kind of awakening of like, well, if I compose stuff, I can kind of really fine tune it. Like, I don't necessarily have to play it myself. I can kind of hand over some sheet music to someone else. And it's like,
So I remember wanting to be in a band. I had a couple bands. Yeah. I had a rock band. I had a funk band in college and in late high school. And the funk band was definitely the most successful. I mean, like, we made one album and
amazing.
We played one gig outside of the city I lived in, so it was like the most successful version of that. But I definitely saw pretty quick that like the gigging life is not easy. Mm-hmm. Right. And I can understand why, like, I kind of understand why so many people have trouble living that life and not, it's just doing whatever you can to like try and break up the monotony and the difficulty of that job. Go ahead.
Well, I love like writing music and like tinkering with stuff. So like, yeah, like the theme music for this podcast. So like, yeah, I just kind of compose it and like, so, well, it sounds like a ripoff of the Godfather theme, but it's basically me learning the Godfather theme, forgetting how to play it, try to play it and be like, you know what? That sounds close enough without me getting sued.
So, I mean, that sounds like my job every day.
Yeah. I'm like a music library kind of guy. Like,
yeah. No, I mean, so it's just, you know, I am tremendously fortunate to be able to do what I do. You know, I have a studio in my house. I wake up every morning. I, you know, get my kids to school, and then I get to sit in a room all day and write music. You know, I mean, there are good days and bad days, just like any other job. But at the end of the day, it's a very unique situation, you know.
There's that thing as well that you can go in with nothing, right, and then come out the end of the day with something tangible, like in a way, like you have this piece of music. You mentioned being in bands when you're in college. Was it composing you went to study at college, or what was it? Was it music related?
Yeah, I actually went and I did music media, and I ended up doing a double major, like a double concentration in music media and music composition.
Amazing.
Which is, you know, it basically like a music production. So it kind of covered film composition, it covered recording, it covered a bunch of different stuff. And then I ended up getting a second concentration because there was only a little bit of hour overlap, and I really wanted to go to USC for their film scoring master's program. And they required a composition degree to get in, or what they called equivalent composer experience, like professional experience. But the real thing for me was, it wasn't even college. I went to a smaller college called the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. And the thing that really was valuable to me there was that they kind of just let me do my own thing, frankly, because they knew I was highly motivated, right? So like, I was kind of an insane person. I was reaching out to USC teachers. I actually like did private correspondence lessons with a teacher from USC because I wanted so badly to do this. And then I actually went out of my way to try and do these things. And they knew I was self-motivated. So they like, as long as I was working on stuff, they kind of let me do what I was going to do. You know?
Yes. What like, from like looking through your IMDb and stuff like that, it's obviously like there's tons of credits, loads of shorts and kind of like movies dating back all the way to what, like 2009. But one of the things I noticed, especially in the more recent years, there's kind of this spate of horror movie soundtracks. Like, was that kind of like something that fed into itself? Like, you kind of do one, and then that gets the ball rolling onto something else, or
I mean, some of that is that. I mean, also, I've gotten pretty good at doing mock-ups, so for a while I kind of was this guy that would get hired to do orchestral, very intense orchestral music that they didn't have the money to hire somebody to hire an orchestra to do, right? So I got really good at doing that. And oftentimes I would, you know, send a track to somebody to get some feedback, like from a buddy of mine who's a composer. He's like, man, like, where'd you record that at? I was like, well, we didn't record it. And he's like, well, and so it was kind of I started to specialize in that genre because in this lower budget world, you do what you can. But I'd realized that unless I really put the time in to make the thing sound real, like it would never sound real. No one's going to record the music for some B monster movie, you know? So rather than it sound kind of cheesy, I just looked at it as almost a puzzle of like, can I fool people into making this think this was real? You know? And it did kind of just feed on itself. Like, some people heard what I did on one movie, and then they were like, oh, I want to do that again. I want to do that. And then they would call me for another movie, you know?
So if I'm getting this right, like, your process is you just create it all in your home studio. So like with a lot of that stuff. So like,
it depends on the budget.
Yeah.
So like the old way, that's mostly live orchestra.
Yeah.
We recorded that in Budapest. And we can get to a little bit later, like the whole process of where we got to that point, like why I did that and what it ended up being. But like a good example is You Might Be the Killer, which is one of those like orchestral based horror scores, you know. I was hired because the director specifically wanted 80s horror, but he didn't want like Carpenter horror, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Squirt, he was like, I want, you know, orchestral horror music. And that was like what got me the gig was my previous work in that genre, sending it to him and him liking that, you know? So that was, everything was in the box. It's called In the Box. So like where it's all electronic mock-up, you know, samples. Amazing. And when you play a button on the keyboard, I play a C on the keyboard. If I have my violin patch open, it plays a recording of a violin playing a C, you know?
Yeah. So when it comes to like stuff like that, like when you get, I guess the old way is a perfect place to, or perfect film to talk about this with. How early, especially with this film, did you kind of come onto the project? Had the film wrapped? I know it can really change on project to project, but how did it work with the old way? Like when did you get involved?
On the old way, I knew, the way I came to the project was I knew a couple of the producers. And they had kind of come on a little bit later in production. I'm not exactly sure when they came on, timeline-wise, but they weren't like at the very genesis of the project. They had kind of come on a little bit later. I think it was to kind of finish up some financing and stuff. And they came on board, and they knew they were going to need to have a... it was kind of this weird amalgamation, like this... I was there coming on board as they had already kind of, they were in the middle of production. I wasn't onboarded as an officially signed, but we were in talking about it and what they were looking at. And as the edit progressed, as they started doing edits on the picture and stuff, they initially had used a very guitar driven score. So it was a much more modern, for the temp music, right? Mm-hmm. So temp music, for anyone who doesn't know, is a lot of times they'll place music in the edit. Yeah. Just to make sure that the emotional moments work. And a lot of times that'll inform what genre you're going to work in, you know, not that it's, we're trying to copy it at all, but just in the sense of like, I really liked how minimalistic this is or how big this is or how, whatever it is, you know? But it just really wasn't working. It was really, the movie is very intimate, right? Like that's the thing about it with the father daughter relationship. Like the movie's really intimate, and with the guitar being so small, the movie felt like it had no scope. Mm-hmm. Like whenever you got to these really big cinematic moments, it just didn't feel like it had the scope it needed to have. So that was when the conversation kind of evolved from, "Hey, I want guitars," to maybe we need to be looking into the more, like we talked about earlier, the classic studio Western vibe. Like, what's the modern take on that? So that all kind of happened as I was coming on board. I think that also kind of helped sell a little bit more me on getting on board, because I play guitar and stuff and I can do guitar based scores, but it definitely takes a much more specific skill set to do like a big orchestra stuff, you know, with other instruments. So that's kind of how I came on board. And the final, I think, I'm not want to say nail in the coffin, because that is a negative connotation, but like the final pushed for Brett to want me on board was, they had sent me a rough cut of the film, not of the film, but like of the opening sequence, so like the whole hanging sequence and the gunfight. And I had this idea banging around in my head, which was to like incorporate orchestra with Rocky Mountain folk music, because it kind of takes place in the Montana area. And so I got excited about it, and I actually wrote the whole opening sequence. I wrote a good portion of that opening sequence. And I think that's what really both sold the producers and the director on the style, and then sold Brett on also bringing me on board.
So you mentioned temp music there. Like, what's your kind of general feeling on temp music? I know for some composers, it can really be like, it can really like hamper the creativity, right? And especially with directors, and I'm not asking you to spill the tea on like Brett here, but like obviously we can talk about it in more broader terms, but obviously directors can become, and as you said, this one probably isn't the case, because it seemed like they were aware that it wasn't potentially working, but they can really get like I really love this, for instance, Hans Zimmer piece we're using here.
Yeah.
And it's like, it becomes, it's like, well, it's like Hans Zimmer's very, very busy. And I'm sure he can't do every, he tries to do every movie, but he can't. Like, are you able to like detach from it? I know that like certain composers, there's a great story, I think Paul Hirsch, editor for like long working Brian De Palma editor and did Star Wars, like kind of said when they showed Bernard Herrmann like Sisters, they had some of his music as temp music, and he kind of lost his shit and said like, why are you showing me this movie with with any temp music, let alone my music? Why are you showing me it with any temp music? I need to just watch the movie and like see how it makes me feel. It's a, like, it's almost like I'm a, and I guess he was at the point where it's like, I'm as much a collaborator in this as
he can,
as
do you, whatever you want. Yeah. Bernard Herrmann can do whatever he wanted. I mean, I think I have a general love-hate relationship with temp. I totally understand why it's needed. I'm not a person who thinks you should necessarily edit without temp or anything like that. And I think in some cases it's very useful, especially on tight turnarounds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a tight deadline and everything's been working with like up to this point, especially if you happen to be working on a TV project or something where you had to get an entire network to sign off on this project, then it can be very good to inform you about what they want, especially if it's really well done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really well done temp music, then you're like, oh yeah, these are the moments that work. And usually you do a spotting session anyway. So I usually like to do a spotting session with the director or the producer, whoever the person calling the shot is. And at that point I'll mute the temp music and we can go through and say like, hey, what if we did this? And we can kind of mess with options. But it's helpful, especially, I mean, most directors and editors and producers are not musical people. And if for some reason words fail, sometimes it's helpful for them to point back to the temp and say, I really do like kind of the emotional tinge that happened at this point, right? On the other hand, you know, sometimes temp music can be an active detriment because it's just there, you know? And to Brett's credit on this movie, him and the editor and the producers all knew that there was a problem, right? They all knew. And even by the time I was coming on board and we were having these discussions, they had started to swap out the music to like some more older Western vibe stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They had like kind of swapped out a couple pieces and said, yeah, I think this would work. Right. So good on them.
Their
credit. There you go. to their credit. So they were, and Brett frankly was really open to collaboration. Like, I think he just wanted whatever was best for the movie, and he's a musician himself. He played French horn in college and stuff. So whenever I sent that scene to him, it really helped sell what I was pitching, right? So it also helped sell him, sell other people on it too. But then there's the dark side of temp music, right? I've had directors where, and I understand you listen to something a million times one way, right? You listen to, you're in the edit and you've listened to your temp music 100 times, you know, and you're used to how it lands and you're used to how it feels. And it's hard to separate from that. So the difficulty comes in with, I've had weird interactions where I've realized that the notes they're giving are not on my music. They're actually on the temp music, you know, like I've literally had that conversation, which is interesting. You know, so I'm not averse to it. If we have the time, I'd rather have no music,
mm-hmm.
right? I'd rather be able to watch the movie without any temp, you know, and really, be able to build those moments without any temp. Personally,
have you been
the world I live in.
I was gonna say, have you ever been afforded that luxury of like being able to go into something cold and just be like,
yeah. I mean, so I always try in the spotting session, especially to have I always try to hold on to my viewpoint as a audience member as best I can. And I take notes as I do the spotting session to try and best hold on to that, because I know 6 months down the road, not even 6 months, let's just say, you know, a month down the road, if you've been watching this movie every day, you've completely lost every kind of perspective that you could have. You kind of have to rely on that initial notes of like, this is what it is, you know? So I've done a couple movies where we did that. I had that experience. Actually, I have a movie coming out in limited theatrical run called Bunker.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming out in the end of February, which is like a body horror movie.
Amazing.
That is focuses around World War I trench warfare.
Oh, wow.
And it was one of those situations where the director, I don't even remember. I don't think there was any temp music in any of the cuts I watched with him. I know there definitely wasn't when we spotted it. And Adrian, who is actually a composer himself, which is wild. I was like, you're hiring me to do this score and you also have written the last scores to your movies. I mean, I'm honored, but, and the score is very in like the, like once again, kind of in that 80s horror, like alien kind of horror score, you know, and it's recorded with the same orchestra that the old way actually. But in that situation, that was completely devoid of temp. Same thing. Actually, I'm working on another horror movie for Adrian right now, but it's like very sound design oriented. It's like
amazing.
My thought process is like, what if like you completely destroyed and mangled a recording of a Cajun band? That's like kind of my kind of my pitch. But it's the same thing. I saw one cut that did have a little bit of temp music in it, but it had almost nothing. But once again, both those movies have had like a very long runway, right? Mm-hmm. Like they basically said, hey, we want you to do this. We want you to have the time to do it right. So, you know, we don't have to rush through this, mm-hmm. right? Which I think sometimes you can kind of rely on temp to guide things whenever you really have to get through it, you know?
So how do you go about building out almost like the toolbox for and like the kind of instrumentation for a score, like with the old way you said about that kind of mix of the classic Western sound and the kind of Rocky Mountain like band sound? Was that something that kind of came to you instantaneously, or was it like trial and error to kind of to get to that, or was it something just about the visuals kind of went that's it for me?
Yeah, I mean, so I think it drew from a lot of places. So first of all, we knew we didn't want spaghetti Western,
mm-hmm.
right? Like that was something that we knew we didn't want. We didn't want full on spaghetti Western. You know, that wasn't where anybody was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of listening to older Western scores and just kind of absorbing a little bit. You know, obviously I try not to listen to too closely to any one thing because I don't want it to be,
mm-hmm.
I don't want anyone to say, oh my gosh, well, that's just a lift of this.
Yeah.
And obviously we're a product of all our listening tastes anyway. So it happens, but generally I was listening to those styles and thinking, okay, well, if I have this bass orchestral palette, right? Like we're going to do this bass orchestral palette. And I've done a lot of scores where I do orchestra with like some solo or some group. I've done a lot of those kind of scores. And I was kind of searching for inspiration. Okay, well, how am I going to do this, right? And some of the things that did work in the temp score were actually in the more intimate scenes going into more of like a guitar-based sound. So I kind of started to dig into that and then drawing inspiration from the location. I had the thought of like, man, I don't, at least in my head, maybe I'm wrong. I'm just not that familiar with that many action movies that are doing like banjo.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just not, it's like banjo and fiddle, you know, they like incidentally show up in scores, but they're just not like, they're usually much more deliverance and less action, mm-hmm. you know?
More of like not a gimmick. Yeah. Always used as like, they're a part of the scene itself or something like that.
Do you know what I mean? Like, or they're like part of they become part of the joke, right? Uh-huh. They're almost like, it's like a cliched instrument at this point.
Yes.
So I thought it was interesting. You know, I just, in my head, I thought, well, it would be great to find a way to bring that vibe into this, like into this classic studio Western. And also one of the things was I didn't want to just remake you know, Lonesome Dove or whatever. Like, I didn't, you know what I mean? Like, I wanted it to have like a newer edge to it. And that was kind of where I drew whenever I kind of dug into the Rocky Mountain folk music stuff. And I also know a killer fiddle player, and he was the one who had suggested working with Seth Taylor. So Steve Reese, who was the fiddle player, he's recorded with me a ton. Mm-hmm. I actually knew him, like we kind of grew up together a little bit. And he's recorded a bunch of my scores, so I knew that Steve would be killer on this. Especially for the more emotional parts, uh-huh. All the parts with Ruth and all these parts, I was like, man, he would be great. And then I asked him, hey, do you know any banjo players? And to be fair, realistically, it should be Clawhammer, which is like a variation on banjo, mm-hmm. but I didn't know any Clawhammer players. So we have banjo. But you know, that was kind of the genesis of this idea, you know?
So when it came to actually like scoring it, you said, yeah, you went out to Budapest. What was that experience like? How big was the orchestra, and like what was the setup like? Obviously, you said you got this fiddle player, you got a banjo player. Like, yeah, what else we got in the mix?
I didn't even travel there. So obviously, like part of the reason you record in Budapest is a monetary mm-hmm. pull, right? So like, and they're great musicians. They're like the players did amazing, but it's like they are. Because they're more of like a budget option. As soon as you start flying there and booking hotels and stuff, it's like, well, you might as well just record somewhere else, yes. You know? And also just for the ease of it. So whenever we tracked, you know, I'm sitting in my studio in my pajamas, drinking a cup of coffee, watching them on Zoom on monitoring them, you know, through, I think we were listening on Source Connect. And, you know, it's amazing. Like Brett, you know, I think I don't even remember where Brett was at the time. Brett travels a lot. So he was on the road somewhere. One of the producers was in L.A. One of the producers was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. My orchestrator is in Michigan. And then my mixer is in Germany. He's working, you know, like amazing. And they're in Budapest. And we're just all on this stream listening, you know, giving notes, giving feedback. And then also, I mean, the fiddle player and the banjo player and guitar player, they're all in Nashville. So like. So, you know, it's very much a multinational, intercontinental yeah. project, you know.
It's amazing.
But it's great. I mean, it's awesome to be able to, like we talked about, I've done a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. And you just don't get that much time to work with live musicians. You know, it's just not something that it's just whether it's budget or whether it's time.
Yeah.
You know, it takes extra time that you've got to get all this stuff written out. Because I'm not actually physically writing, you know, notes on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's all played into a DAW. And then if it's going to be recorded, then I send it to my orchestrator and they write it out and we send it to someone else, you know? So it's definitely a luxury to be able to sit there and listen to all your music get realized, you know?
Yeah.
I think on this score, I want to say it's like a 55 to 60 piece orchestra. It's a good size orchestra.
Yeah.
You know? I have some video of the sessions up on my YouTube channel too, if anyone's amazing. Interested in checking it out. But, you know, it was a great size orchestra. We did split up the group. So we did what's called striping.
Mm-hmm.
So we did the strings and woodwinds together. And then we did brass separately. Partly you do that. So that way, for time's sake, because like the brass had so much less to play, you don't want just players sitting in the room, not. Yes. Recording, you know, maximize your time and budget. So, and then also it just makes editing everything a little bit easier, especially if you don't record in some huge studio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the brass players can really easily overwhelm the woodwinds and strings. Even a small number of brass can really just destroy the sound in the room if they really get at it, you know? So, you know, I think we recorded everything in like 9 hours.
So with these kind of door compositions, like these kind of, I guess they had demo tracks for it. Like,
mm-hmm.
how far? Like, obviously, there is something you get from a human playing it. But like, how different are they? Do you know what I mean? Is it kind of like to the untrained ear? Would you like be able to be like, oh yeah, that's like everything's there. Do you know what I mean? Is it everything's there? You can hear like. All the flourishes, or is there scope to when you get the players to to tweak stuff, and like stuff doesn't work when you hear it played by a human, as it were.
It just depends on the project, right? I am classically trained as a composer, so generally I know what works and doesn't. And then there's another added layer of like my orchestrator is also classically trained. So, you know, if for some reason I'm like, oh, I just wrote that just to write it, then my orchestrator's like, yeah, that can't be played that way. He'll take care of that as well. Whenever I'm writing when there's going to be live orchestra, I definitely keep that in mind, right? Like I'm always in mind of, is this playable? Is this executable? Because that's studio time that you have to pay for, right? If for some reason there's a problem, then you got to stop and figure it out. And that costs money, you know? Yeah. So I try to be very hyper aware of that kind of stuff. On the difference between the orchestra, I mean, when you AB it, it's you can really tell, right? I did some pieces recently that just had gotten turned down from studios. So like demo pieces that whatever, you know, for whatever reason, it doesn't work out. And I really like the tune, so I had them live recorded. And like, yeah, they're fine when they're in the mock-up stage. You know, they sound fine. It's you know, I mean, I spend a lot of time tweaking them and programming them so that they would sound better. But man, there's just something about the live sound, especially when you're going to a more like classic, like 80s, 90s score that just doesn't come across. Like it's the phrasing, it's everybody in the room. It's just all these elements that come together that are really hard to replicate in samples. And when I mean like, you're going to be sitting there tweaking and tweaking, tweaking, trying to make it sound right, trying to get the performance you want. Where whenever you do, the live players just do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And there are other composers. There are certain composers in Hollywood that have really figured out like samples sound really good doing this, right? Like this one thing, right? Like they sound really good doing short notes and they sound really good doing held notes. Right. So that's why we get these kind of monolithic scores, I think, that do these ostinatos and have these big block chords. And yeah, they sound really cool and they sound really interesting, but they're not, you're writing to the samples rather than writing to the players.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I was always fascinated by different processes. I remember watching like a short documentary. I think it was on either the Life Aquatic or the Royal Tenenbaums, of how Mark Mothersbaugh like did the scores for those, and kind of he did them with live players, but one at a time. So almost like kind of like treated them like you would like a rock band. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a kind of like tracking an album and stuff like that. And like the way he managed to, and I guess that's a skill of its own, right? To like, oh, we can get players. So we've got the oboe player playing separately. Then we've got like this, we've got a horn player, we've got a string player, all playing separately. But then when you put it all together, it's like, oh, that sounds like people playing in one room. Right. And it's kind of like, it's that same thing of like, you saying about how to like utilize samples and stuff like that. And like you say, like obviously there is care and attention put to the demos, but then obviously you can never replicate. Do you know what I mean? Like
you're trying to replicate the thing that you can do.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like all this time, you know, I'm going to make all this time replicating a guitar with a keyboard when you could just pick up a guitar and play it.
Yes.
You know, obviously sometimes, like we said earlier, sometimes it's a matter of money. Sometimes it's a matter of time and you just don't have it. And then, or matter of circumstance. I mean, there's been a bunch of scores over the last 2 years, even major scores that were step recorded one instrument at a time because people were in lockdowns, people were in separated spaces, you know? So, and I have a big band album that I did that was completely recorded that way. Like, me playing saxophone, someone else playing trumpet, someone else playing, and that's fine. But it's like, if you can afford to do it, right? If you can afford to have the players in the room, I mean, it's just, in my opinion, it is night and day.
Yeah.
Right. Like just what they bring to the table. There's a reason why they're professionals. Right. And, and I am a professional composer, but I'm not out gigging and playing shows and playing orchestra concerts, you know? That's just not, you know, even down to how they perform on the instruments, like what's idiomatic, even on the old way. You know, I would write an idea for Steve, the fiddle player, or for Seth, the banjo and guitar player. And obviously for the guitar, it's like, I know what I can play guitar, but I'm not. He's like a virtuoso banjo and guitar player. So I always just told them, I said, look, here's basically what I want. If there's something that doesn't work, like, feel free to try something else. You know, like, yes. It's just, this is what I need. I need something that's fast or moves like this. I need something that does these things, right? So, and 9 times out of 10, what they sent me was, probably 10 times out of 10, what they sent me was better, right? Because they know their instrument,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
So it's like, we're spending all this time writing music for other people's instruments, and generally, like, they're going to know how that instrument works better than I do. You know?
Yeah. It's great to hear that, like, being open to that, like, collaboration, especially, you know, like, yeah, especially on a score like this. Like, there's such, like, I don't know, there's a grandiosity to it, and that, like, there is something, I think especially that fiddle and that banjo really do stick out of being like, oh, this sounds, there's something different to this. It's kind of like, yeah. it's got something that, I don't know, like, just really, really draws you in. Do you know if there's any chance this music will be, like, released in any way? Like, because obviously you've got a few of the scores you've done have made it up onto streaming platforms and stuff like that. Like,
yeah, it should. The plan is it's supposed to be released on February 17th.
Amazing.
You know, on streaming platforms. Trying to get all that buttoned up. Just end of the year, kind of.
Yeah.
As always, end of the year got everything going sideways. That's the plan. I'm really excited. And I mean, the cool thing about also on this score, I think the other thing that kind of is interesting about the fiddle and banjo stuff specifically, actually, is that there's a lot of modern processing on them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bunch of delays. There's a bunch of, like, it's not just fiddle played like a fiddle.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there are moments that it does that, but there are, once especially we get into Ruth's theme after she's dead, it's all processed. It's mm-hmm. like almost every time it's on the fiddle after that, it's processed with some kind of delay, some kind of reverb. It feels like really ambient and haunting. That was the whole vibe. And then also with Brooke's theme, a lot of times the banjo also has a bunch of delay and stuff on it. So you get, like, these really modern elements on these old instruments. Amazing. Right?
Yeah. So when does that come into the process? Like, is that like an early idea you have, like, kind of, we're going to kind of use modern technology to kind of warp these instruments slightly and kind of do something interesting? Or is that there a bit of experimentation with that in the demoing process?
There's definitely experimentation. I think specifically the fiddle stuff when it comes to Ruth actually came about in the spotting session.
Mm-hmm.
So as we were going through the movie, you know, we're going through in the spotting session. Basically, I usually sit down with the main creative and we'll watch through the movie and we do very exact notes of, like, hey, the music comes in right at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
It comes out right at this moment. We need to have a hit point. So, like, a really important thing we have to hit is this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the style we're looking at. This is the emotions we're dealing with. Right. That's what we do. Well, we were doing that in the studio and the director's sitting on the couch. I'm sitting at the studio desk and we're kind of going through it. And as we get through this moment, we kept coming back to this conversation of, like, we need Ruth. Ruth is this, even after she's dead, is this reoccurring character to Briggs, right?
Yeah.
He's been changed by her. And the whole movie, we're asking, like, how permanent is that change?
Yes.
Like, how permanent is the change that has come about in him? So the director, Brett, really wanted to have this brooding idea. So we have this darkness of the old Briggs comes that kind of swells and comes back and pulls him in one direction. And then we needed some kind of idea that would call back to Briggs and pull him away from the darkness. So we knew we needed this idea of this, like, kind of haunting calling mm-hmm. idea. So during the spotting session, I said, well, let me pitch you an idea. So, like, I pulled up a fiddle patch, and as we were watching, I think it was the scene with Briggs in the barn as he's mm-hmm. like discovering the her death scene or whatever. I like kind of put just some basic delays on it and reverbs, and I like pit and I played it for him like live while we were doing it, just on my keyboard, and he really loved that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, like that was kind of his touchstone. He's like, yeah, let's get back to that moment of with us in the studio of you playing that back for me. So that was kind of an organic happening, right? But when it came to also the banjo, and once I kind of introduced that idea of like, what if we had these modern tones, like now he's like, well, I could put it on other things. I could put it on the banjo. I could put it on the guitar. I could put it on these other things. And it kind of organically created this more modern tone, which is what we talked about, right? Bringing the modern tone to the classic Western sound, you know?
I was just thinking as you're saying that, like, I've listened to enough of The Cure to know if you want moody and brooding, like you put a bit of delay and reverb on something, and that's the vibe you're going to get straight away. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, man.
The whole of 17 seconds is like, let's just whack up that delay and reverb and like, let's wallow in it.
Perfect.
That's perfect. Well, before I let you go, I just wanted to obviously you've done some stuff with TV, like, and animation as well on the Owl House. Like, how does that like differentiate? Like, is that process completely different with animation? Like, are you, or is it the same? Are you giving it like it's animated, the voices are on, and now here's some music for it? Or are you brought in earlier on in that case?
Well, the Owl House is a unique case because I got brought into co-score with another composer. So they had a different composer in season one. For whatever reason that didn't work out, they hired a guy who I had worked with before, who's Brad Breek. He's awesome. He did like Gravity Falls, and he's done a bunch of stuff. He's really been big in the animation world. And we have the same manager. That's how we met. And so he called me, actually, I think I had just finished The Old Way.
Mm-hmm.
And, he called me and he said, hey, I have this show that I think I'm going to need some help on. It's just very time consuming. It's a very time consuming show to write on.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a bad way. It's just, it's very animated. You know what I mean? I don't mean animated in obvious it's animation, but like you're hitting each moment, right? Like you're hitting, it's not quite like Mickey Mouse level where it's like dump, 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 dump. But it is like, oh, somebody does something and you have to hit their reaction. And if something hands someone to someone, you hit the thing. So he had some other gigs going. He wasn't sure when this was going to land and he needed help. So I got brought in to work with him on that. So it was already kind of something that was rolling, right? And it was their final season. Instead of doing a whole season, they were doing just three like specials. So they're doing 3 hour long specials. So it was kind of like a pre-existing framework that I came into to help him out on. But normally on animation, they have such a long runway, you know, like to get started because they require all this pre-production and all that. So when I've auditioned on other shows, they're kind of like in the animatic stage. They're not super fleshed out, but. You know, once you're writing on the shows, it's, I think we would have a conform. So like they would send us a what they called a latch version. So it's not quite locked, but all the animations are there. The voice actings are probably like 80% there.
Perfect.
With a couple temp stuff. And maybe every now and then you'll get a very basic animated shot that isn't quite done yet. And then they send you a final version that you then conform to.
Amazing.
And you make sure that everything hits correctly and you know whatever they cut or added makes sense, you know.
Amazing. Well, yeah, thanks for coming and joining me, Andrew.
Of course.
One of the questions I always like to ask people, especially if they've had an involvement in a Nicolas Cage film, obviously you've got a horse in the race, so this one can't count, but what is your favorite Nicolas Cage film? Do you have one?
Man, I don't know if I have one. I mean, so I have like, and this is probably a terrible, terrible answer, right? And the reason I say that is just because like I have a nostalgic place for it, right?
That's the best place for things.
Yeah,
to be
sometimes. Exactly. I mean, I personally, from like a like bubblegum pop standpoint, loved National Treasure. You know what I mean? Because like I watched it as like a kid.
Yep.
And it's like, it also like was in my mind is like before cliched Nicolas Cage, which was actually like one of the reasons why I wanted to work on The Old Way anyway, was because I watched it and it's like the anti Nicolas Cage at this point.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. He's an enigma. As somebody who's kind of been through this like wild journey of like watching all of his films and kind of studying them, he's a man who's like, I don't know, every movie is a dice roll, and the fact he's 40 years into a career and this is the first Western he's been in is baffling.
Yeah, man. No, I mean, it's great. And that, and I think like from a purely bubblegum pop nostalgia perspective, that's what I'd say. But he's just done so much. It's just so wild. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Was it, what, like, obviously, yeah, you would have known that he would have been in this project. Was there like I get to score a Nicolas Cage movie? Like, that's kind of like,
well, I mean, that was part of the draw, right? Part of the draw was, yeah, I get to score a Western in a like classic Western vibe, which is something that's a lot of fun. Like, I love that. I do love that genre. My parents are a bit older. I grew up watching older Westerns and John Wayne films and stuff. So like there is that component, but like watching Nick Cage, especially once I saw it, I was like, well, this isn't Nick Cage doing Nick Cage, you know, which is unfortunately, I mean, maybe not unfortunate for him, but like often is what he's hired for.
Yes.
You know, it felt different, which was nice. Like doing something, it wasn't just, there's a lot of these guys who were just kind of like, all right, I show up, I show my face for 10 seconds and I get my check and then I leave. It's like, he's in the whole movie. He doesn't get killed off in the first 20 minutes.
Yes.
You know, he's in the whole movie. He's doing his job. He's doing a different kind of character. The other thing that really did bring me to the project was the idea that, and it's never like explicitly talked about, but it's obviously heavily inferred that the two characters are on the spectrum.
Yeah.
And it was something that was really interesting, right? Like, it was never like, how does somebody like that cope living at the time?
It's a great way to, because I think if it's signposted, then you kind of lose the sense of the time, because with it being unsaid is, yeah, I think as we said when we discussed the film on the podcast, was the language didn't exist when this movie set.
And also just generally, there was a challenge in that for me too, because when you watch the movie, the performances, because of who they are, the performances to some extent felt a little flat, not because they're actually trying to be flat, but it's like, these are the characters, right? Like they don't experience emotion the same way as we are, or they don't express it the same way. Mm-hmm. So one of the challenges was I really have to do some work on that. Right.
Yes.
So, that was part of what brought about the jelly bean scene being like the banjo stuff. The banjo has like a really great character to almost have like a curiosity to it.
Mm-hmm.
But also still has like a bit of a mathematical quality to it. Like, it's doing these arpeggios and stuff that feel very like locked into time. They feel very, very metronomic, right? And very calculated, but it still has this upbeat and lightness to it. Right. And then the same thing happened in the fire scene, the fire scene between Brooke and Briggs. Like, it was without music. It's still, I mean, they're still doing a great job acting out the character, but it's like, we got to kind of fill in the blank a little bit.
It's kind of dawned on me now. Like, and I think that's why the score resonated with me, is obviously not, it's doing a lot of heavy lifting, 'cause that sounds like damning with faint praise, but like, because the characters, and it is, they're doing amazing performances with it, but they are somewhat emotionless. It gives, I guess that was a bit of a blessing for you in a way, right? In that, like, you kind of get to internalize or bring out something in the emotionality of the film that obviously the characters themselves can't express. And that's what movies should be doing, right? Is like everything pulling together, the visuals,
just nothing. I mean, it's just kind of part of what we do as filmmakers. Mm-hmm. But I think for sure, I mean, even I remember hearing you talk about this on the the on your other podcast talking about the old way. It's like the moment in the shop whenever there's the cut in, there's like the close up of Briggs as the guy is talking about the apples. And you just know he like wants to pull out a gun and just end this guy. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like he's just you could just see him like in a previous life, you would be dead right now. You know? And in the opening, the whole thing was we had to really show like here's this guy trying to exist in this world. And that was actually, like I said, one of the things that brought me was an interesting challenge, right? Like, let's play some of these jokes. Let's play some of these moments where it's like, mm-hmm. this guy is pissed off that he has to sit here and listen to your bullshit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? or, especially at the beginning, like he has this very inquisitive daughter who just, and like any parent, your kids will ask you a million questions. And he's, you know, walking her to school and he's just being bombarded with questions, right? So like playing each of these moments and trying to highlight his frustration mm-hmm. and their interaction was actually this great opportunity to amp that up a little bit more. Because without the music, it just, like you said, it doesn't highlight what they're doing mm-hmm. enough, you know? Yeah. So it was, I don't know, man. It was a blast to do, you know?
Amazing. Well, yeah, as you said earlier, is the next thing we can expect from you, like hearing music you've composed, The Bunker, right? You said that's out in February.
Bunker, I think, comes out, it's late February, and I don't know, it's limited theatrical release, so I don't know wherever it's going to go, but it will be also getting a soundtrack release. I'm shooting to have the soundtrack release at the same time.
Amazing.
But that's a fun movie, but it's definitely... if you're into body horror / war movies, you know, it's definitely those two things.
amazing.
You know, and I think the last episode of the Owl House that I scored comes out in March. I think I don't think they've announced the official date, but they seem to be releasing it every 3 months. So I think that's the last episode. And yeah, man, it's exciting stuff.
Where's the best place for people to keep up to date with like anything that you're doing? So obviously as you compose stuff for more stuff and stuff starts coming out, like at the kind of upcoming on IMDb, it's kind of a good decent amount of projects
to be prolific, you know. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter as Andrew Morgan Smith is usually my handle on those.
Cool.
I'm Andrew Morgan Smith Music on YouTube. I try to do behind the scenes stuff and
amazing.
I talk about, advice for composers and sometimes filmmakers and do behind the scenes videos as well. Those are kind of my big spots. And obviously my website is andrewmorgansmith.com. So
perfect. Well, yeah,
new things on that. Yeah.
I'll be sure to drop all of the kind of links in the show notes so people can easily find it and check out the work. And if you listen to this conversation and you haven't seen the old
if you've
way
made it this far,
definitely do watch it and be sure to check out like your streamers for when the score drops, because even isolated I think it's gonna be a lot of fun. I'm already looking forward to hitting the treadmill with some of the cues in this, maybe not some of the roof, maybe not the roof cues, but some of the more like upbeat stuff, I'll definitely be
doing
a power walk too. Well, Andrew, thank you so much again for coming and getting caged in with me.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it.
And there you have it, guys. The fantastic Andrew Morgan Smith. What a fantastic conversation. What a lovely chap. Hope you enjoyed that as much as I enjoyed recording it. It's always fascinating to learn about the processes of people and their kind of creative endeavors. I feel enriched and enlightened after having conversations like this. And I like to think that the podcast is not just like about Nicolas Cage and the Coppola family, that it's about filmmaking and all of the kind of facets and things that go into it, and this is one of many of them. And I'm always fascinated to talk to anyone kind of in any aspect of the filmmaking process. And as things progress with the podcast, I hope to do that lots and lots and lots more, kind of eventually a talk to, I don't know, people who work in all different departments, but that's producers, the gaffers, someone who works in lighting, PAs, assistants, kind of what it is entirely to make a film. Get the insights from all of those people. If you had fun with this one, as I said, like in the episode, do check out Andrew's stuff. I said I'd put the links in the show notes. They will all be there. And if you want to get in touch with the podcast on any of the socials, you can do. And that's all at Caged In Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok. Or you can drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. As for next week here on this podcast, I said in the intro would be kind of tentatively stepping back into the Coppola Connection strand of the podcast. And we will be doing that kind of in a tangential way to ease us back into the Coppola family. And that is to speak about the recent furore and rumours around the making of Megaropolis, Francis Ford Coppola's long gestating passion project that he's self-financed, and the rumours that that has fallen into disarray, and how Francis has fought back. And so I thought next week I would talk to one of my favourite people to podcast with, Claire Ellen Hope of the W-Rated podcast, all about kind of Francis Ford Coppola's history with troubled productions and some of our favourite and kind of they're well known, but kind of discuss some of the bigger production snafus that have happened throughout cinema's history. Just the chance to kind of talk about them wild things from history, but also to kind of litigate what is happening. What do we think is actually happening with Megaropolis? Is it on the straight and narrow, or is it kind of a freight train careening for destruction and mayhem? Who knows? It may be both of those at the same time. And that sounds like a lot of fun to me. So be sure to join us next week as we talk all things Francis Ford Coppola and production issues. If you enjoyed this episode or any other episode of the podcast, please do take your time to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now. And remember to leave a 5-star rating and review. And always let me know what you think Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation. So as ever, guys, I've been Petros Patsilvas. I've been Caged In. You've been amazing. And I'll catch you next time.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.